This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. People will believe almost anything when it comes to the quest for eternal youth. In the 1920s, a man with dubious medical credentials set up shop in Kansas. He then succeeded in convincing thousands of men and women that virility could be restored by the surgical implantation of goat testicles. Before he was finally stopped, John Brinkley had killed unknown numbers of people, become fabulously wealthy, created the first radio empire, and invented modern political tactics. In a new book titled Charlatan, writer Pope Brock details the rise and fall of John Brinkley, a fraudulent doctor and a marketing genius. Pope Brock is here in the studio throughout the hour. We'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments about this really extraordinary man and what he managed to do for both good and for ill. Do join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Pope Brock, it's good to see you again.
Great to be here.
I must say, I have never in my life heard of John Brinkley. How come you heard about John Brinkley?
I stumbled on his name on the internet. I was looking for a book subject, and I thought maybe a hoax would be interesting. So I found this website called Museum of Hoaxes, and I was just trolling around on it. Ran across this guy's name, John Brinkley, goat testicles, radio empire, and I just followed my
nose. Sounds fascinating.
Yes, well, all it took was that. Get me
and home. Tell us about his life. He was born.
He was born in the Smoky Mountains of North Carolina, very poor, in a log cabin. He loved comparing himself to Abraham Lincoln as a result of that, and scrabbled his way off of that farm. He was a quack early on. I mean, before he put together this signature riff of his, he started off as something called a Quaker doctor, which was standing on the back of a wagon selling tonic. And then he moved on to something called an electromedic scam, where he was injecting electric medicine from Germany, supposedly, into the rear ends of people in Greenville, South Carolina. He sort of platformed out from there.
And the early 20th century, I guess, was ripe for that kind of introduction of new things, exciting things, possibilities.
Oh, it was wide open. I mean, coming off of the First World War, it was the age of science, technology. You know, the airplane was new, and instant coffee had just been invented, and they were smashing atoms for the first time in the 20s. So people began to think that just about anything was possible. So that's what made it a great time to be a quack.
What kind of an education did he have? Was he truly a physician?
He got three-quarters of the way through a sort of shaky medical college in Chicago, but abandoned it without a degree. Even if he had had a degree, he wouldn't have been any expert. But he had some knowledge. When he wasn't drunk and when he put his mind to it, he could perform basic surgery.
And so this notion of selling the power of implanted goat testicles, how did that begin to come about?
Well, there's a sort of legendary moment in his mythology where this farmer in Milford, Kansas, named Bill Stitsworth, showed up one day and said, I've lost my pep. I'm a flat tire. things like that. So Brinkley said, I don't know what I can do for you. And they're looking out the window at the livestock out there. And the farmer supposedly said, it's too bad I don't have billy goat nuts. And that was the eureka moment. So Stitsworth became the first person to be experimented on. And so much of this is in the mind, of course, the virility. That's part of why it's such a successful thing to be involved in. Once he healed up, he came back a couple of weeks later. He was smiling. About a year later, his wife had a baby. She insisted on goat ovaries, and they named it Billy, apparently after the goat. And he was off to the races.
This sounds like a total fairy tale.
I know, doesn't it? Yeah.
It really does. Now, have you been able to find actual evidence that this happened?
Well, evidence that it happened? I mean, there are all kinds of testimonials. And I mean, he went through the goat testicle implantation. He performed at least 16,000 of these over the course of his life.
16,000?
Right. People were lining up out the door.
How many people lived and how many people didn't?
Well, that's unknown, but he killed dozens and dozens. That's he was signing death certificates and he was tracked down, and some people survived the operation, but then they would go home and Brinkley's sanitary standards were not the best. So,
well, and going back to his medical education, you say he only got 3/4 of the way through it. Did he have surgical training?
He had some, but he didn't have enough to prevent infection in a number of cases. So a number of these people died of lockjaw or peritonitis afterwards. He was drunk frequently. So not obviously outrageously drunk, or nobody would lie down, but he was... He performed this surgery before and after the cocktail hour.
How much money did he charge for this kind of surgical treatment, do we know?
$750 a pop.
A pop.
And this is in the 1920s. I mean, this is 750 1920s dollars. This is an enormous amount of money. So that's the size of the stars people got in their eyes.
We are talking about a book with a billy goat on the front of it. The book is titled Charlatan, America's Most Dangerous Huckster, The Man Who Pursued Him, and The Age of Flim Flam. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. The second part of that subtitle concerns Dr. Morris Fishbein. Tell us about him, who he was, and when he first began to learn about your friend here.
Morris Fishbein was the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And early in the 20s, he became interested in quack busting generally. There was so much out there. It was just all these gadgets and vibrometers and foot-powered breast enlargers and things that there was just way too much to stamp out. But Brinkley rose so high above the normal ruck here that he got Fishbein's attention. And from the mid-20s on, Fishbein got him in his sights and tried desperately to bring him down, but it wasn't easy.
Did the operation, I mean, you said the first farmer came back with a smile, his wife had a baby a year later. I mean, to what extent did this operation seem to work, and why didn't people just die of the operation, every single one of them?
Well, not everybody got infected. I mean,
the implantation of goat testicles in a grown man, the implantation of goat testicles in place of ovaries in a woman. I mean, this is nutsy.
Yeah, well, you can't think of implantation as a sophisticated surgical procedure. In his case, it was opening up, say, the scrotum, opening up, tossing it in, closing it up. It was that simple. As long as infection wasn't introduced, then the body would absorb this foreign matter. It would just dissipate and disappear.
So many of these people claimed they felt great afterwards, and that's how his Brinkley's reputation spread.
Oh, yes. He got dozens and dozens of testimonials. I mean, so much of male virility is in the mind. So as long as they survived the operation, he had plenty of people bouncing up and saying, this worked great. I feel 20 years younger. Plus, he had herds of goats, out in back of the clinic. And when patients would come, they were invited to go out, browse the herd, and choose the most simpatico goat. So they felt that they were, in tune with the animal that they were getting a part of.
How many testimonials are out there, Pope?
Oh, he published a book called Sunshine and Shadows that had at least 100 testimonials from men and women. He had a testimonial from a United States senator from Colorado, the chancellor of the University of Chicago Law School. He got some pretty big names.
And Hollywood stars as well.
Well, Hollywood stars, this is part of the lore. No Hollywood star stood up and said, this was when he went out to Los Angeles at the invitation of Harry Chandler of the Los Angeles Times. He did work on a number of very prominent people.
The book is titled Charlatan, and Pope Brock is the author. When we come back, we'll talk further, take your calls, your email. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back to a conversation with writer Pope Brock. His new book, titled Charlatan, is all about a man whose name is John Brinkley, was John Brinkley, who made a reputation on selling the notion of virility to people whose, I don't know, their strength, their sexual impetus was flagging a bit. He decided that the transplantation of goat testicles into both men and women was a way to restore that kind of virility.
Well, but once he had that out there, and that was a success, he discovered that it also treated 27 other diseases.
Like?
Oh, everything from emphysema to flatulence. I mean, if you had it, he could fix it with goat glands.
Here's an email from Roger, who says, I have been writing a screenplay about the good doctor for the last 12 years. His ability to outsmart his opponents with technology was without equal. It was not until he threatened to run for president in 1940 on a peace platform was he ultimately taken off the air. Of course, we haven't even gotten to the point where he established a radio program and began prescribing his own medications to people on the air.
Yes, that's right. I mean, once he had made this national, even worldwide reputation, he, in the early 20s, he made a tour of Asia, putting goat glands into people in Peking and so on, you know. So he had a large reputation. Once he had that established, then he began to move into other areas.
How much money was he worth at the time he established his own radio network?
Well, by the 30s, in the depths of the Depression, I mean, a hard figure I can give you is that in the depths of the Depression, say 33 to 38, he made at least $12 million a year. So he was doing phenomenally well, phenomenally well.
And how did he manage to get into the radio business and why?
Well, here's part of his genius. He was a dark genius. When he went out to Los Angeles in 1922, he saw the first radio station that was then being built by the Los Angeles Times. He had an epiphany. He went back to Kansas, got a broadcast license, which was easy to do in 1923. He saw the future. Sales, sales, sales. So he builds this radio station, broadcasts all over the Midwest, and then it begins to go out from there. And he began to send the message of goat glands out across the prairies. And it was that kind of marketing. I mean, it was a combination of what he was selling, but also his marketing that really put him on the map.
He really understood how word of mouth over the air could become such a potent form of advertising.
Yes, absolutely. And people were still trying to figure out how do I play the saxophone on the radio? You know, I mean, they didn't know what was, but he saw it immediately, and built this empire way ahead of most people. I mean, corporate America was way behind the curve on this. It wasn't until after the crash of 29 that they began to look at, oh God, what are we going to do? We've got to keep people buying. What? And then somebody looked down and said, well, look what this guy's been doing. I mean, he's making a fortune down there.
So he starts an enormously popular program that dispensed medical advice on the air called the Medical Question Box.
Yes, exactly. I mean, his career was not just goat glands. He then moved up to something called Medical Question Box, which was a program where people would write in. It was women mostly saying, I'm worried about my husband. They'd write in, describe symptoms, and he would toss off diagnoses on the air. And he roped together about 500 pharmacists with medicines with the labels disguised so that you wouldn't know what the ingredients were. They all had numbers so that it sounded very, you know, scientific. And then he would prescribe these medicines over the air. And people went out. Not only did he prescribe, of course, to the person who wrote in, but then people, other people listening in, they think, oh, my goodness, I've got that, too. So then they would go out and buy, and people began to die. You know, there were reports, and doctors were writing into the newspapers and so on. You know, it's like, my patient just, you know, ruptured bladder, whatever, because of what this man is dispensing. So he became even more lethal.
And I gather this was prior to call-in radio. They were actually writing in their questions rather than calling them in.
Yes, that's right. And it was so successful. He had eight secretaries going through the mail every morning. And then they would sort out, they'd pick out about 75 that they thought he should look at. So they'd throw the rest away. And then he would go through some and kind of pick out what he liked, what he thought he could riff on, and do that over the air.
And these people would then go out and buy.
Religiously, religiously. He had this wonderful, soothing kind. Another thing that made him stand out was that he didn't have a big announcer's voice. He would sit at the microphone and talk to you as if you were right across the table. And that was a new technique. He was like Arthur Godfrey before Arthur Godfrey came along, you know. And so he became a friend of all, you know, thousands and thousands of people who came to believe that they knew him as well as they knew their own family.
What kinds of medications was he actually prescribing on the air?
Oh, there were a variety of things. I mean, he was getting things from Merck or Park Davis and switching the labels around or disguising the labels. Some of them were old-fashioned recipes for itch problems. You know, you'd grease yourself a hog lard and put on Long Johns and lie in bed for 3 days. And so it was really the gamut.
But then we had this Dr. Fishbein.
Yes.
Who's watching all this happen.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of actions does he begin to take? And what about government regulations at the time?
Well, there were no government regulations. Being a doctor was, you could pretty much declare yourself a doctor. There was a diploma mill scandal. You know, people were buying the diplomas of dead doctors.
But what about the Federal Radio Commission that was in existence?
Well, it was in existence, but it was brand new. It was in the late 20s.
With no authority.
They were still figuring out what radio was. I mean, he got the jump on everybody. So there was no corralling this guy for quite a while. It wasn't until 1930 that they finally threw a lasso over him.
He actually ran for governor of Kansas because he had tremendous appeal.
He had so much appeal that when Fishbein and the Kansas State Medical Board finally succeeded in revoking his medical license, this was in the summer of 1930, 3 days later he announced for governor. And he had huge crowds, enormous crowds, the greatest crowds any politician in Kansas had ever drawn. And this, again, was a function of his radio campaigning. But he also introduced the airplane to campaigning. He introduced...
He would do jumps, skips, and hops around.
He bought an airplane from Charles Lindbergh and would rally hop. And this was the first time any politician had done this. So he dramatically increased the number of hands he could shake and the impact that he could have.
This story is utterly fantastic and fascinating. And Pope Brock, I'm glad you're here to tell it. Let's open the phones and hear what listeners have to say about the book titled Charlatan, America's Most Dangerous Huckster, The Man Who Pursued Him, and The Age of Flim Flam. First, to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Randolph. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Pope and Diane. I have an anecdote. My father grew up in San Antonio, and he was a pilot when he was very relatively young. And after Dr. Brinkley's death, and I'm sure you'll get into it later, that he had some serious problems with the Internal Revenue Service, but there was a question about a lot of the money and where did it go. My father tells a story that he was in the shack one day where he flew one of his airplanes, and Mrs. Brinkley, his widow, came in and took the chief pilot back into the room, and Mrs. Brinkley and the chief pilot came out a few minutes later. The chief pilot was white. And my dad said, what's going on? And he reaches in his pocket, and he pulls out a handful of diamonds.
Huh.
And what Mrs. Brinkley had done was, she said, Doc wanted to pay you, but he couldn't, so I am. The story was, she reached in her purse, pulled out, measured a handful of diamonds, put it in his hand, said thank you, and walked out.
Wow.
The amount of money that Dr. Brinkley took in must have been staggering.
It was staggering, and he had a passion for diamonds. He used to wear diamond tie pins and diamond cufflinks, and he had a ring with a diamond the size of a human eye that he used to walk around with.
Oh, my.
And one other thing is, and I'm sure you came across this, you know, he also loved sporty-looking cars. He had silver, sterling silver hubcaps made for him in Mexico with the words Dr. Brinkley on it. And he'd ride down Del Rio with these sterling silver hubcaps.
Oh, absolutely. He had his favorite car when he was in Del Rio. His favorite car was a red Cadillac. He had about a dozen Cadillacs all in his garage. But his favorite had Brinkley embossed on it in 13 different places.
Oh, my gosh. Randolph, thanks so much for your contribution this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's talk about Mexico for a minute, because after losing the election in Kansas, but apparently not by terribly much, and having already lost his medical license and the radio station, he had another brilliant idea, which was to build a mega station in Mexico. What did he do? How did he do it?
Well, this was just the next level of brilliance. His radio license and his medical license were both taken away at pretty much the same time. He had been struggling with the wattage and so on for, you know, he wanted more. He thought that the limitations, 5,000-10,000 watts, it was just a way to strangle his genius, basically. He realized that if he could go down to Mexico, and not far in, just across the border, just across the Rio Grande, and set up a radio station there, then he could pump up the wattage and blast his message over the Western world. So he went down to Mexico. Mexico welcomed him with open arms because
He had so much money.
He had so much money, and because the Mexican government was furious at the United States for hogging the bandwidths. So they thought, oh, here's an opportunity for revenge. So they were partners in revenge, the Mexican government and Brinkley. He built this station. He went from 150,000, 350, up to the point where he had 1,000,000 watts going.
Wow. At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, Myron. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Diane, I like your show. I listen to it often.
Thank you.
Your guest, do you spell his last name like the candy, B-R-A-C-H?
No, B-R-O-C-K.
Thank you. I'd like to read his book.
Sure.
But I am familiar with the doctor. He was in Arkansas, right outside of Little Rock, for a while. I'm not sure about the time period. I've read about him.
Mm-hmm. Late 30s he was there. He had a hospital in Little Rock.
Yes, outside of it's still there, about 10 miles outside of town.
Oh, that's right. He had a hospital in town, and then he took over a country club outside of town. That must
exactly.
be what you mean,
it was
yes.
a country club that went bankrupt during
right.
the Depression, and he took it over. And now the Catholic Church owns it as a priest.
Well, I hope they had an exorcism before they took it over.
It's got a nice lake there beside it, a man-made lake, and it's called Mary Lake Monastery now.
Hmm.
But I don't understand why he came from Kansas and then maybe to Arkansas. Did the AMA run him out of Arkansas? And then I thought he went to Texas from Arkansas.
No, Arkansas was his last stop, essentially. He spent most of the 30s in Texas and Mexico. He got into a dispute with another doctor who was trying to sell his same techniques, basically, to cut rates. There's this big frenzy, and Brinkley always had a temper. So he blew out of town, out of Del Rio, and went to Little Rock for the last couple of years of his career.
But this was thing, the stations that our station that he had down there, I thought he had his business operations on the American side and the transmitter on the Mexican side.
That's right.
Also, a lot of country music artists at that time got their start on his big megawatt station.
You're absolutely right. He's the man who made the Carter family a national institution. They had been big regional stars up to then. But he was the first, because the reach of his radio station, which didn't just cover the country, it went up to Alaska and across to Finland, and Montreal was complaining about interference. So
well, sure, thank you. I'd like to read your book.
Well, thanks very much.
All right, Myron, thanks for calling. Isn't there some indication that the power of that wattage was such that bed springs would shake?
Yes, in the local... in the local area, yes, people said that, and that Brinkley's voice would wander in and out of their phone conversations. His technician said, if you go in there, the hair on your arm, if you go into the transmitter room, the hair on your arm stands up. It was so powerful.
And yet, I mean, this guy had a wife. Did he have any children?
He had one. Minnie was actually his second wife. She was the love of his life. They had one child after quite a bit of trying. He made it.
Did he use goat
testicles?
Well,
he made it abundantly clear to the public that he had not needed goat glands to father his child.
The book is titled Charlatan, Pope Brock, B-R-O-C-K, is the guest. We'll take more of your calls when we come back. This has got to be the most bizarre topic we've ever had on this show. Fascinating.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. By the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Cellist Yo-Yo Ma is one of the premier musicians in the world. His recordings routinely top the classical music charts. He talks about his Silk Road project, his love of collaboration, and the state of classical music in the U.S. and the world today. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back with Pope Brock, who has chosen to write about a really fantastic character whose name was John Brinkley. Pope Brock's book is titled Charlatan, and in it he describes the kind of way out things that Pope Brock John Brinkley succeeded in doing, such as telling people that the transplantation of goat testicles would help their virility. Here is an email from Miguel, who says, I was born and raised in Del Rio, Texas, which, as Mr. Brock knows, was Dr. Brinkley's home for many years toward the end of his life. My question is this. Does Mr. Brock think that Dr. Brinkley actually believed that what he was doing was helping people, or did he know what he was doing was a huge money-making scam?
He knew it was a scam, and I say this not just because of his history in other forms of quackery. There was some misguided, wholly deluded, but extremely sincere research going on at the time into glands, and there was a man named Voronoff in Europe who thought that he was on to monkey glands. He thought that they could, if they were correctly installed, could make a person live to 150. I mean, it was wrong, but it was respected. It was out there. He was conducting serious experiments. Brinkley took this idea, took out the monkeys, put in goats with all those associations, particularly for the farm community where he started out. And that's what he started with. And then he made no attempt to experiment, to publish his findings. He would put the goat testicles in. It was like tossing them into a bag. Or sometimes, if the mood struck him, he would chop them up and toss them in. It didn't really matter to him exactly what he was doing. And he would refer to these people as fools after they were gone.
Here's an email from Laurie, who says, not to be too gross, but how was this done? Were the patient's own testicles removed and the goat testicles sewn in? How could goat testicles be placed in female patients?
Goat testicles weren't put in female patients. Goat ovaries were put in female patients. I don't have the slightest idea how he went about doing that.
For women.
Or if he actually did it. You know, it's the kind of thing where you could wake up and say, you know, be told that this had happened to you and go home. No, the human testicles were not removed. The goat testicles were added because, unless he introduced infection with this procedure, because there was no real attempt at a graft, the body would absorb the goat testicles into itself. They would just dissipate into the system and evaporate, essentially, so that after it was all over, nothing had changed.
And here's an email from Pete, who wants to know whether there are any recordings of the gland man's radio broadcasts which survive.
There are, yes. Not of the 1920s, as far as I know, when he was getting his start. But there are some from later in his career, from the Del Rio period.
Can we actually hear him selling goat testicle cures on the air?
Not in the recordings that I have found. I won't say categorically that they're not out there, but the ones that I have found are from the mid-30s to 39. He abandoned goat glands in the early 30s. So the broadcasts that I have are talking about other procedures and the prostate problem. He went on to, he made the prostate the king of his supposed empire for the latter part of his career. There's a lot of his talking about how you come and we'll straighten out your prostate without surgery, like the Amateur Meat Cutters Association, which is what he liked to call the AMA, without them getting at you, just come and let me take care of it for
you. All right. Well, you're going to be very interested in our next caller, whose name is John Brinkley, calling us from Hickory, North Carolina. Good morning to you, John.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. How about you?
Just fine. My friend Norma Frank from Hickory, we're in a play called The Road to Mecca. She called and told me this was on the radio, and it just so happens that I've been working on a first-person show called An Evening with John Brinkley, and he is a relative of mine from North Carolina. I have always been interested in it and studied it some, and went to Del Rio actually a couple of years ago to see the home place.
Isn't that something, that home?
The people. Pardon?
Isn't that something, that home? That mansion? Isn't that something?
on a cell phone. And
well, he was saying, did you actually see the gorgeous mansion?
Yes, I did, and took a picture. They've got a plaque out in front of it that has his name on it, which is my name. I'm actually John Brinkley III. And they wrote an article in the local paper because we look alike. And the only difference is I don't have the goatee that he had.
Well, you can paste that on. You sound like the ideal man to portray him on stage.
Well, John, thank you so much for calling, and good luck in your performance.
Well, thank you, Diane.
Take care. Let's go now to Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Marvin. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. A friend of mine, it's funny that you have this show because a friend of mine's father was one of Dr. Brinkley's transmitter operators. And when he left Del Rio, one of the other things that were happening, the locals over in Mexico were so aggravated with both his medical procedures and the transmitter that he had to leave, and they not only had he went, but the people who worked for him, his transmitter guy, they had to actually sneak him out of the country in a trailer under the tower that was taken down because the locals wanted to do the guy bodily harm.
Wow.
Well, that might have been true for a time, but his station, even after his death, he was told it was being shut down, but it resurrected itself within short order. By 1941, it was back on the air with different personnel, same idea except without Brinkley. And that went on to broadcast country music all over the place.
And a lot less power, too. I mean, we have, in fact, this friend of mine actually has the station logs from when Dr. Brinkley was there.
I wish I'd found you people before I wrote the book, Diamond Man and you know.
This is so fascinating, and this is why I love doing this program every day. You never know what to expect, and when you open the microphones, you hear from everybody.
Right.
Marvin, well, thanks so much.
You bet, and have a very nice day.
You too. And now to Kathy in San Antonio, Texas, who also has a connection to Dr. Brinkley. Kathy, go ahead.
Well, my connection is also through my father. After Dr. Brinkley had moved to Del Rio, he bought the yacht, the Shadow K, which belonged to Carl G. Fisher, who was the developer of Miami.
Right.
And the yacht was docked there at the time. I think this was during the Depression. Or sometime in the 30s. And the yacht came with my father, who was the chief engineer on the yacht. And my father sailed it over to Corpus Christi, and they docked it there. And then these stories all came to me through my mother, because this all happened before I was born. But and my mother actually always spoke with a little bit of a disparaging tone in her voice when she was
kidding.
Yeah. And, you know, that man who transplanted goat gonads into men, so that sort of thing. But they took the yacht one time, the Shadow K. He probably changed the name, but I don't know what it was named after that. But they took it one time. My father went, you know, with the yacht down to the Galapagos Islands, and they collected some tortoises from the Galapagos Islands and brought them back to Del Rio. I was on a business trip to Del Rio once during the 80s, and the young woman who was chauffeuring me around drove me by Dr. Brinkley's large old mission-style home with a large, you know, walled area, and she said, oh yes, people, the tortoises were here in the yard, and people would come on Sundays, like going to the park.
He had a whole walking zoo going there. He had flamingos. He had penguins there for a while. Imagine being a penguin in Del Rio. What that would have felt
grief.
Like.
All right, thanks so much,
Thank
Kathy,
you.
For joining us. One more caller from San Antonio. Thomas, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
Diane, my driver's license just says Thomas Brinkley Mansion, Del Rio, Texas. My partner and I bought the house and restored it and lived there for about 10 years until just recently.
Wow. Is it so gorgeous?
It's unbelievable. It has a pipe organ with over 1,000 pipes that we restored.
Yes. You know, he hired away the organist of the Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood to come and play it for him. He loved organ music more than any other kind. That's wonderful. Well, you bought the house.
Yeah, we lived there for about 10 years, and both of us, my partner and I, both were there as children.
And that's why you wanted to buy it.
Well, my grandfather knew Dr. Brinkley, and I interviewed Mrs. Brinkley a dozen times.
What was she like?
She was amazing. She was a very, very practical, very down-to-earth woman, and he kind of thrust her into the spotlight and made her kind of the center of his propaganda. He put his son up also, Johnny Boy, as the center of the propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the best stories that that I hadn't heard yet is on the radio, The Light Show. Brinkley had a four-acre park across the street from the mansion, and around dusk, people would start to gather there and fill that park and then start lining up on the street. And there are dozens of recollections of this, but the neon lights would come on at dark, the pipe organ would begin playing,
mm-hmm.
the fountains that General Electric showed at the Chicago World's Fair would begin to dance and change color, and then his staff would parade exotic animals across the front lawn while movie lights danced on the clouds. And they said that you had to sit in line for over an hour just to drive by the house.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Who says crime doesn't pay?
Exactly.
Thomas, can I ask a personal question?
Please do.
How much did you pay for the house?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I promised the new owners. I will tell you that when Mrs. Brinkley left the house, they offered to give it to the city. And they said you could just have it. And nobody would take it. It has the most beautiful chandeliers that are original to Dr. Brinkley's day, built for the house. It has over $500,000 worth of walnut paneling just in the ballroom alone. It's over 8,000 square feet. And at that time, no one would take it even for free.
Mm.
It had 16 acres of grounds with tennis courts and a swimming pool. It was absolutely splendid. And we have the hubcap from his Cadillac It hangs on the wall of my conference room. And our collection of Brinkley is going to be on the Antiques Roadshow this month from San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, fantastic.
So
you're
not going to tell me how much you paid for that house.
Actually, I will tell you. When we bought it, of course, it needed restoration, and we paid $200,000.
Exactly. And I'll bet you sold it for an awful lot more.
We did, of course. Now it's the most valuable home in Del Rio, now that it's not a haunted house anymore.
Exactly.
And I will also tell you, I hope if you're ever in the area, we'd love to talk to you because we have written the musical, Roads Courageous, which is about Dr. Brinkley. And it's inspired by our 30 years of experience with all the Brinkley people.
Oh, sounds wonderful. I'd love to.
Well, good luck to you, Thomas. Thanks for calling.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
At 5 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And finally, to Mary, who's been waiting for a long time. She's in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning to you.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
This is just amazing. I have to tell you, I listen to your show all the time, and I love it.
Well, thanks.
You have some of the most fascinating things on. And, I mean, you've actually had on topics that have affected me personally. Well, I have a son that I found out he's 42 and he has Asperger's.
Oh, I see.
So we found out a few years ago, and you had a program on Asperger's, which was fascinating.
I'm glad.
You know, but this guy, my God, he had the most chutzpah. I don't know if you know what chutzpah is.
Oh, yeah, I know what chutzpah is.
It's a Yiddish word that means he had a lot of gall. But why didn't the AMA or somebody catch him?
Good question. Well, there were a couple of reasons. During the period where he was operating, the media, in any kind of large sense, had not been invented yet. So people could sort of scramble from place to place and not be corralled or put out of business. I mean, Morris Fishbein, the guy who was chasing him, he was writing articles in the Journal of the American Medical Association, compared with Brinkley broadcasting at 1,000,000 watts. I mean, who's going to win that battle? So that's what kept him going until finally Fishbein baited him into a libel suit in 1939. And this was his downfall, because ultimately that's what exposed him fact by fact as a quack. That caused his downfall. And it was Brinkley's collapse that finally put the AMA in control of medical standards across the country.
The book is titled Charlatan, all about America's most dangerous huckster, the man who pursued him, and the age of flimflam. Pope Brock, congratulations. That is quite a book.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.